I didn't get around to all the groups in the first session, but the ones I was at, it was fun to watch some of the discussion that was going on and some of the practical things that people came up with in order to look at how when you come with confidence that God designed the family, I think it really makes an impact on how we then treat our families and how we look at our family and what God brings into our life with our families. And then hopefully you can carry those concepts into your ecclesia. I mean, some of the obvious kinds of things, though, that we don't even talk about sometimes and think about is that your family is where God allows you to practice the love of God. I mean, it's such a simple concept, you almost don't even think about it. But he does that in a framework to where you have a natural affinity with your children. If you have children or your parents or with your spouse, that you love them, that you have this emotional connection to them. And he's hoping that when you do that, you'll learn to experience a bit of the love of God, and that then you can take that into your ecclesia and learn how to love one another. Or you take another simple concept about, the idea of mercy, so that you come up, and I think by nature, a lot of us tend to be much more judgmental than we are merciful, which is why you find out that mercy triumphs over judgment. It's a problem. Our natural tendency is to become a judgmental person and find the flaws in somebody else and see the little speck in their eye and not realize about the mote in my eye. And so God gives us opportunities to practice that in ecclesial life and in our families. And so he brings into our families then, you can imagine how the angels, they custom design things that happen in our family so that we get an opportunity to learn about mercy, because by nature we wouldn't want to do it. And so he and our children sometimes, you wonder like, well, why did my child do that? Well, maybe that's an opportunity for us to learn about the mercy of God. Or why did my spouse do that? Like, not everybody else has to live with that. But when our spouse does something for which you might think, well, we could be judgmental. And say your spouse even commits adultery. It's like we can look at that and say, well, I'm going to judge them for that, and by law they should get this. Or you can look at it from the perspective of, well, maybe God's trying to teach me to become a more merciful person. And so he gives us chances to practice that in our families, hoping then that we will bring that to our ecclesias and learn to practice the loving kindness and mercifulness of our Heavenly Father. So it really is a great design, because we have much more of a natural affinity to do that with people we love, and then we can hopefully do that with the people we're learning to love in ecclesial life. So that was part of the game plan of all of that. Now, learning to give your life for your bride like Christ did for you, I really think that's a major one in terms of like this subject this week, is that a lot of us are married, some of us are not, so if you're not married at this point in life, you just... It's not like you look at this stuff and you say, well, this doesn't apply to me. Instead, what this is all about is learning to give your life for your bride, which you then can take to the ecclesia and realize, wow, this is what Christ did for us, and this is what we should do for one another. He laid down his life for us, and we can lay down our lives for each other. So, you look back at this and realize, look at what he did do for us, and look at what he accomplished on our behalf. So, if it's moving forward. Now, the passages. So these aren't going to be new things to most of you. You've read these passages a bunch of times, but we're looking at them from this perspective of this is what we want to take home from this about learning to give our lives for our bride. So those of us that are married, we go home, and this is what we deal with in our family lives, so that no matter what happens in our lives, we can learn to give our life for our bride like Christ did for us. So look at what Paul says, though, about husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the ecclesia and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious ecclesia, not having a spot or a wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. Now, we read that a lot at marriages. That's one of the common Bible passages we bring up at marriages. And then sometimes later on, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line in the marriage, the guys, we forget that this is what we were called to, that this is what we agreed to when we took our brides, on the day when we made a covenant before our God that we would give our life for our bride. And Paul's reminder is that, look, it's all based on what Christ did for us. And I think the more we understand and appreciate how much we don't deserve what Christ has done for us, the better we can then go to our families and say, all right, it's not that our bride has to earn it from us. It's not that she has to deserve it from us. It's that we are modeling the relationship that Christ has with us. And you can see how Paul, as he's going through all this, you know, and he goes back to like we're members of his body, and for this reason shall a man leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And he says, it's a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the Ecclesia. So even though it was about Adam and Eve, and the general thing is written back there in Genesis, it really was about Christ and the Ecclesia. They were always the model. Adam and all the things that the angels did with Adam and building Eve and taking Eve out of the side of Adam, it was all by design in order to illustrate the redemptive process we would all go through. And so we have been called then to try to model this. This is our practice time in our homes of learning how to appreciate what Christ has done for us. And it really, it tells us that when you go home, this is not an equally shared responsibility. I think at a brother's weekend, you can point this out and honestly realize that for all of us that are married, if the model is that we represent Christ in the family, if that really is the model that we're building it on, then we have to go home realizing we bear the responsibility, as Christ did, of saving his ecclesia. It's not a case where you come into this with a partnership and say, all right, we each, the husband and the wife, we each bear equal responsibility. God lays on us, brethren, the greatest responsibility of maintaining that marriage. It is our responsibility to do everything we can of laying down our lives for our families and for our spouse. And it really isn't an equal thing. We can't do what Christ has done for us. And really, that's the model that we are out to represent. We are supposed to show that with our wives and also with our kids. And he's hoping that our children will see that, that dad goes the extra mile. Dad goes beyond what was even expected because you're trying to mimic what Christ has done for us. So that's really the way Paul uses the concept there when he brings that up in Ephesians 5. You can see it in Romans 5. You know, again, you know the passages that the model is based on the fact that, look at, we weren't worth saving. If you think you were worth saving, I don't think any of this means anything to you. And we don't understand it. If we really think as a person that we were worth saving and that we had a right to be in God's family, then all of a sudden you lose what we're being asked to do in our families of what Christ has done for us. And it's all based on the fact that at the right time, Paul says, when we were powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. That's us. We're in this category. Paul calls us powerless, ungodly, and he says, well, look, very rarely anyone will die for a righteous man, though for a good man, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And it wasn't a daring death. God calculated for 6,000 years he was going to give his son for us. And it was while we were sinners, while we were powerless, while we were ungodly. And the key is, we don't deserve it. You can never earn it. It's by the grace of God. And when we understand that, really come to grips with that, then you don't expect other people to deserve it and earn it from us. And all we're doing is just transferring down the way God treats us. He's now allowing us to practice that in our families. So you don't expect your kids to deserve it. They don't have to earn it. Our spouses don't have to. Our wives, they don't have to earn our love. They don't have to deserve our love. The model is that we love them the way Christ loved us. And so there are no excuses. You just can't go home and make excuses for yourself. You have to apply the model and realize God is trying to teach us what he went through to save us. And that's what he's hoping for. So really, every husband's goal really should be to help save your wife. That's what we want to go home with this weekend, is we want to realize our goal is to save our wives and save our families by so doing. And so you aim at that target, and yet you don't lose track, you don't get out of focus by the fact that your mind starts playing games with the fact that, well, she did this, and I don't really think she deserves it, and you know, there's all these games we can play inside our heads. And the old man is extremely deceitful. So you stay focused on, what did Christ do for us? He gave his life for us. He did everything was for us. That is the way it's presented. And he did all that at a time when we didn't deserve it. We could never earn it. But that's the way he treats us. And that's the way we want to go home and treat our spouses. And the amazing thing is, the way God has designed it, because he's the designer, is that he realized that if we do that, brethren, if you go home and really put that into practice, your wives will respond. And it's not a case of where you're doing it, but you're waiting for them to earn. Instead, we just go overboard and show them the love of Christ and what they will do. And for the most part, is most women will respond to that. And they will. They'll appreciate the fact that you're willing to give yourself for that marriage and to try to bring it to really a positive result. So we do. We go home and we bring Christ into our marriages and we try to give ourselves for our bride in every way. We don't want to, you know, wait for her to deserve our love. You don't have to, she's not going to earn our love. Instead, we just set out to save. And that's the perspective that God has always had. So when mistakes are made and things go bad, and you know, you use those as an opportunity to pour out more grace. I mean, it's really fun to watch it. That's actually what James says. There's an awkward passage in James chapter 4 when he talks about, you know, people fighting and arguing amongst one another. And he goes back and makes an analogy to the case of like when you would bring your wife, if you thought maybe she committed adultery, and you bring her and she's pregnant, and you know, she has to drink the water of, the story in the law. But he says, that's what we do. We tend to be judgmental like that. But he goes on and he says, but God pours out more grace. And it's like, that's the perspective God has. He doesn't hold those things against his children when they come to him and they say they're sorry. Instead, he pours out more grace. And it's really, that's the perspective we need to come to. So we recognize that God is involved in our lives and he's using our marriage to save us. And so whatever happens in our marriages, we trust that the angels are there, God is in control, and that he's using that marriage to develop our character so that we don't become angry, we don't get all upset at situations. Instead, we sort of step back and we look at the bigger picture and we count to 10 and we realize, well, what am I supposed to learn from this? What is God trying to teach me? And if we respond the right way and we respond with the love of God, that it's amazing how often those problems in the marriages disappear because our wives appreciate the fact that we responded that way. So you can see this is what Paul is really after when he writes to the Colossians. This whole section in Colossians chapter 3 when he's dealing with if we have this new mind in Christ, that if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. You set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are the earth. So you don't come at this from a perspective of humanism. It's not going to help us. You don't argue from the case of what, as a human, what I think might be the right way to do it. Instead, you look for the evidence in the scriptures. We look for our Bible evidence, as a lot of you were doing in that first discussion group. For you've died, and your life is hid with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is our life, appears, you'll appear with him in glory. He then goes on to say, whoops, next one down. He's jumping on me. So, put to death, therefore, what's earthly in you, fornication, impurity, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming. And he admits, look, in these we once walked. You used to be like that when you lived in them. But now he's expecting us to change the way we live, change our behavior. So we put them away, anger and wrath and malice and slander and foul talk from your mouth. See, in our families, in our nuclear families, this is where we practice. And some of you commented on the fact that, well, when you do this in your family and something happens and I lash out, I say, why did you do that to your child? Or you argue with your spouse. And then you come to meeting and you don't act like that. Is that putting on a facade? Is that just like, you know, pretending to be somebody that you really aren't? Well, not really. If the game plan is that you realize when I lashed out that was a mistake, I don't want to be like that. Hopefully then when we come together as a group, we're learning to control those things, and hopefully our behavior at home is getting better as well. Because the new man, that Paul calls it, isn't going to act like that. It's being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. And in this case here, it's going to really change the way that we live. That's the hope. So we put on then, as chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassion and kindness and lowliness and meekness and patience. Now those are all things that we talked about in that first session about what we can learn from our nuclear families. And we forbear one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. See, these are the things we practice in our nuclear families. And we practice with our spouse because this is how God is teaching us to become a member of his family. And as the Lord has forgiven you, you also must forgive. We don't have a choice. You really don't have a choice. So when our kids mess up, when our spouse makes mistakes, we don't get angry. We don't get angry and tear into them. We don't hold it over them and say, well, remember 2 years ago when you did this? You can't do that anymore. We have to let those things go, and we have to become a forgiving person in our families. This is the practice time, and our spouse is probably one of the greatest places to practice, because we interact so often with our spouse, and we both make so many mistakes. We can catch each other up on our mistakes very easily and remember them and bring them to the surface. And this is our opportunity to practice. So, husbands, he says, love your wives. Do not be harsh with them. And when you see those statements in the Bible, those are words that were chosen by Paul, because that's the natural tendency, is to be harsh with your wife. It's the saddest thing I've watched in my life. I can't believe it. But you think, how can we do this as guys? Well, we take on a wife, we love her so much, we get married to her, and then as years go by, we treat her worse than everybody else. You see this happen in families, because we almost think like, well, she can't do anything about it, or you know, she's not going to walk away, and it's almost like they're trapped. And so often we treat our own family members worse than we treat other people. And so Paul warns that don't be harsh with them. You're going to have a natural tendency to want to do that just because of our nature. So the principle does extend to all circumstances too. You can't sit here and make excuses for ourselves and just think, well, what if our wife has a bad attitude? Or what if she's sick a lot? Or what happens if she has bad habits and she's gone to addictions and things? This goes all the way across the board. We have to try to save our spouse. That's what we've been called to. And God was willing to do that for us when we didn't deserve it. So, you know, you look at all the different situations you could be going through with a spouse and all the cases that you could have. We can't talk about them all today, but we can't make excuses for ourselves, brethren. It doesn't matter. God has controlled the family, and he has brought the spouse to us with all of those situations. He knows it all. It's in his control, and he's doing it to teach us about his character and how to be a member of his family. And it's really in his kindness. So when you look at some of the common problems that people run into, and you talk to marriage counselors today, these are the kind of things they say cause problems in marriages. You have lack of communication. People don't talk. They all of a sudden go their own ways, and they don't communicate. And so when we go home, if we've had this problem in our marriages, we want to work at sitting down, having time together, and talking with each other. The inability to adapt to changing situations today is huge, according to the counselors, because things are changing all the time. Your family changes. Kids are born sometimes. You have economic changes that take place. People lose their jobs. And all kinds of changes, work, health. You know, who could ever anticipate all the changes that were going to come about in the next 10 years on the day you got married? You know, and some of you would look back and say, well, if I knew that was coming, I don't know if I would have married that person. And if I knew that it was going to go through this, I don't know if I would have married them. But God doesn't make those mistakes. We have to have the confidence that he will use those situations to improve our characters, and we can help save other people. Lack of commitment in the marriage is another common one. Problems with sex is a common one that people mention, and the reasons why people turn away from one another or seek solutions outside their marriage. Or unrealistic expectations, where sometimes we can expect things of our spouse that they were really never able to do. We thought, you know, when you go into a marriage sometimes, some of us thought, I'm going to change her into this thing that I picture, and she's going to become like that perfect wife that I just have this vision of what she's going to be. And it's like, is that what you would want her to think of you? Do you think that she's sitting there looking at us thinking, oh, I'm going to change him, I'm going to make him this and this? She already is, right? Just keep her that way.
I didn't think I got this way.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully that does happen sometimes. But it happens when there's cooperation. But I don't know, some of the counselors in our area, they've mentioned to us that that's one of the common problems, though, is that people think they're going to change the other person into some unrealistic expectation. And then there's the lack of time together. You know, some of us now have jobs where they take you out of town and you get so involved. Some of you were asking that question earlier about how do you balance family life with a collegial life, and all of a sudden you got to go to the arranging meeting, you got to go to the Bible class, you got to go. And it's almost like you can get so busy in a collegial life that you have no time to spend together. And so these are just the warning areas right there. We got to be careful that we don't let those things go after our marriage. And so you start to monitor them. You just mentally, you just go through and you say, all right, are we communicating? You know, am I spending time with the family? You know, are we handling and trying to tackle some of those problems? And we try to tackle them before they become big problems. So as many of the counselors say, really, for the dads in here, at least that have kids, the best thing a dad can do for his children is to love their mom. You know, and ahead of time, you might not even realize that and not even understand that, but this is what the kids are looking at. They're looking at the relationship that dad has with mom. And God is hoping that if your children watch the way you give your life for your wife, that they will then very easily transition into the idea of what Christ has done for us. And that God's perspective of the family will somehow be taught to the kids by the very way that we live in our families. It really is a great design, but ahead of time you might not think that was the case. So you look at a case like Malachi, you know, when he ends the Old Testament there in Malachi, and he asks that question that, the you know, Malachi, it's one of those common ones that we look at, about they were coming before God, and God says, look, I'm not interested in your sacrifices. I don't really care about all that formal religion you have. And you ask in verse 14, well, why? Because the Lord is holding you accountable. He watches how you treat the wife you married when you were young. You have broken your promise to her. You did it even though she's your partner. You promised to stay married to her, and the Lord was a witness to it. We made a covenant before our God when we got married. And hasn't he made the two of you? It's like, don't you understand? He's the one who designed all this. He made us. And both of you belong to him in body and spirit. And why has he made you one? Because he was looking for godly children. Hey, Malachi just spells it out so clear. The game plan God had all along was that with mom and dad, when dad loves mom and gives himself for mom, that dad is going to have an impact on your kids to where they will understand what God has done for us and what Christ has gone through for us. And that it will just sort of like flow into their life and they'll learn that concept by experience. So guard yourself in your spirit and don't break your promise to the wife you married when you were young. I hate divorce, God says. I hate it when people do anything that harms others because he realizes the impact it will have on the kids. And he doesn't want our kids to go through that. He wants them to learn about godliness. Now, those of you that have the King James, I always thought it was interesting to look at this idea that when it talks about right here, hasn't he made the two of you one? The King James is about the only version that at that point says, and why did he make only one? You know, he made only one. It's almost like if they're right, which and I've never been able to figure out from the Hebrew, and none of the other translations take that perspective, but it's an interesting one that they might argue the case that when the angels were looking at Adam and they realized it wasn't good for Adam to be alone, the angels looked at Adam and said, all right, we'll make a helper suitable for him. They didn't make Adam two wives, three wives, four wives. And the way it's worded in the King James, it says, and was it like there wasn't enough spirit left? Was there no residue of the spirit? Like, were the angels out of power at that point and they couldn't make another woman? No, they only made one because what God wanted was godly children. And he designed the family with a mom and a dad so that those two components would teach our children all about God and Jesus Christ and about our relationship to them. That's what the kids are supposed to see in the marriage. And his goal was that he was looking for godly children. So, you know, sometimes we don't think about that as parents, but our kids are watching, and this is one of the ways that God is going to teach our kids and work in our families. So now it's time to find out what you guys are thinking, and we'll have plenty of time to discuss, hopefully, this second round.